I wanted to leave you with one simple result today in the following circle of ideas. For a long time, we've had the idea that if a sufficiently large quantity of matter is sufficiently collapsed, then it'll collapse to a space-time singularity. Sufficiently collapsed means size less than or equal to the Schwarzschild radius, just m in dimensionless units. In all three dimensions, this connects back to Thorne's loop conjecture. And one doesn't believe that gravitational collapse of cigars will lead directly to black holes. There's some very well-known theorems due to Penrose, Hawking, and Garoche that say once you have a trapped surface, then you'll have gravitational collapse to a singularity. We would also like to believe that if there's a trapped surface, there's also a black hole. But you have to know that cosmic censorship is true to get from here to here. So there's kind of a complicated story, which is still not closed. There's a slightly less well-known theorem due to Shen and Yao that says if you have matter, enough matter which is condensed enough, and I'll tell you how they define those terms. They're mathematicians, so they define them very precisely. Then there will exist a trapped surface, and then we can move down in this picture. There's also a related theorem by Bobby Begg and Neil Amurhu, which helps a lot in these matters, although it's somewhat difficult to apply directly because their criterion is rather implicit. So the result I want to present today is spiritually similar to the Shen and Yao theorem, except it doesn't depend on the presence of matter. It works equally well with gravitational radiation, vacuum curvature, and so forth. Numerical relativists have been collapsing Brill waves for years, and this is a theorem that says, yes, they can do that. The Shen and Yao theorem is now about 15 years old. Gary knows about these because of the acknowledgments. He's the only name to mention, actually. It's a com math fizz, and when enough matter is condensed in a small enough region, gravitational effects will be strong enough to cause collapse. So these guys are mathematicians, but at least physicists have taught them to write clear English in their abstracts anyway. So let me tell you how they did this now. They defined the size of a region as follows. It's a little bit intricate. The basic idea is we have a region which they call omega, and we want to measure its size. If we're in flat space, that'd be easy. In curved space, it's not clear what you mean by the size. But they wind up defining it as the minor radius of the fattest torus you can fit into that region. So we try a bunch of tori, which are constructed by, first of all, starting with some curve gamma. Gamma could be any curve that lies within this region. And we fatten it into a torus by enlarging it by proper distance, say some proper distance r. And then we make r as big as possible without closing off the hole in the torus. And we try that for all curves gamma and tend to find the fattest possible torus we can fit into a region. So for instance, if this region, red region, were exactly a sphere, not quite in my picture, but if it were, and its radius were capital R, then the minor radius of the fattest torus you could fit in would be precisely r over 2. And that is then the Shen and Yao size of this region. And now here's their theorem. They then use their usual wizardry to prove that given some matter density, and you can think about this is just a density, but some dominant energy condition kind of thing, actually, then if the size of the region, in the sense that they just defined, is greater than 1 over the square root of the density times some universal factors, then there exists a trap. There exists an apparent horizon. That looks a little funny, but the dimensions are actually right. The density is, of course, something like a mass over a radius cubed, and in general relativity, that has a dimension 1 over r squared, so you want 1 over square root like that for the dimensions to work out. So that's a powerful theorem, but as I mentioned, doesn't work when you have only gravitational radiation. Also depends on the density obeying a bound everywhere, and therefore, if you have a large neutron star and evacuate a little hole in the center of it, a vacuum, then the theorem doesn't apply anymore. So it'd be nice to have some way of getting around that, too. So what I did is prove another theorem using much of their technology, and the approach is as follows. The size of the region I define by a much simpler criterion, namely, simply I use the volume to area ratio or area to volume ratio. Simply measure the total three volume of this region, measure its two-dimensional area, and then the surface to volume ratio is 1 over a distance dimensionally, and that's what I use to characterize the dimension of the volume. And then how do I characterize the strength of the gravitational field in this three-dimensional slice that we're in? Well, I have to find some technical thing which actually then works out so that a theorem is provable. And I have to use some, I look at the components of the second fundamental form or extrinsic curvature of our three-dimensional solids lying in spacetime and do some minimization procedure. So once again, we're back to minima, and it's possible to break the theorem simply by wiggling something a little bit in the local region. Let me explain a little more carefully what this is. The simplest way to explain what the criterion for the extrinsic curvature is as follows. At any point on our three-dimensional slice, we can diagonalize the extrinsic curvature. It's got three eigenvalues. For instance, if you're in a Kasner universe, they go plus, plus, minus. They might be two-thirds, two-thirds, minus a third, or something like that, times some scale. Well, what you have to do is pick out the two smallest of these eigenvalues at every point, and then furthermore minimize that over your whole region V, and that's the measure of how strong the gravitational field is according to this definition. Now, of course, in general relativity, what we measure always depends on our frame of reference. And this quantity came in, first of all, it depends on the slice that we pick. If we wiggle the slice some, the extrinsic curvature will vary around some, and this came in will vary some too. So yes, this is slice dependent, but it does not depend on the matter at all. It really depends on the gravitational field. Okay, and then having defined those two things, the size of a region and the strength of the gravitational field in it, we have a theorem. The theorem says if you have an initial data set, that is a three-dimensional slice containing a three-dimensional metric and a three-dimensional extrinsic curvature in general relativity, and by the way, it's supposed to be asymptotically flat or something. I've left out some conditions here, but it's the usual sensible stuff. Then if the strength came in, measured in this way, is greater than the surface-to-volume ratio, then an apparent horizon exists somewhere in the initial data. And so that's the result. It doesn't depend on the matter at all. I've run through a number of examples, and I won't tell them all now, but it works both in matter and in vacuum. In matter, of course, you depend on the matter setting up some strength of K, for instance, through the constraint equations, and then you use the K. So you get roughly parallel results, not exactly the same, but roughly parallel results to the Shonan-Yau theorem. But it also works, say, you can prove the amazing result that the Schwarzschild black hole contains a trapped surface using this theorem. It does work there, too. One place it doesn't work, by the way, is on a maximal slice. In a maximal slice, the sum of those three eigenvalues, K, is zero. If you're picking out the lowest two of them, you don't have much control over positivity there. On the other hand, it works fine on many trace K equals constant mean curvature slices. And does not depend on it, on the other hand, does not depend on that at all. It's perfectly general as regards trace K being constant or not constant. I've mentioned the examples. Let me just say a word or two about the proof. The proof is actually pretty straightforward given the technology that Shonan and Yau are built up. It depends on Zhang's equation, which goes way back to Chicago and Bob Garosch and so forth. And it's a certain equation. And the basic method of proof is to use this equation, use the existence theory of this equation built up by Shonan Yau, and derive a contradiction. And what is Zhang's equation good for? Well, Zhang's equation is basically the obstruction to an apparent horizon. If you can solve Zhang's equation, then you don't have an apparent horizon. And in fact, under suitable, sensible physical conditions, asymptotically flat and so forth, it's really the only obstruction to the existence of an apparent horizon. So that's the outline and proof. I think I'll stop there and ask for questions.
Yeah. So can you give us a better intuitive feeling for this criterion that is the
Well, extrinsic curvature describes expansion or contraction of our system, at least as measured in our particular slice. The usual sign convention due to MW and yourself, K positive K means things are contracting. So the basic idea is we're measuring contraction by the fact that K is positive over some whole region. And then comes the fine print, K1 plus K2. you can think of that as having to do with focusing geodesics in the transverse direction. It's something about you need to be able to focus in all directions rather than just in some overall average sense. So it's each direction that's important. If you're focusing in all directions as measured by picking all normal vectors and taking the transverse part of K there, then that's sufficient to cause gravitational, to cause a trapped surface. That I think that's the best way of thinking about it intuitively. Are you running this or am I? you run it. Yes, it is quite easy to break the theorem by wiggling the surface. If I have a surface and it's generally collapsing, say we're inside a collapsing star, and the criterion holds, then you can always make a little wiggle here so some little piece of the surface will seem to be expanding. And yes, that breaks the theorem. So it does depend on having some way of picking surfaces that are reasonably even. Yes?
And so you have a point-wise condition.
Yes.
In particular,
you
have this little
tiny
region in which
RK can't handle. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, I would love to do that. I tried some and couldn't do it. You graduate students, I think that's probably a good problem. Find some similar theorem to this nest of theorems that doesn't depend on point-wise minima, but just uses some integral property of the total energy in the region or something like that. That would be a very good thing to do, I think. Yeah, Roberto.
It's dependent on the slicing.
Yes.
But if you have matter, for example, a fluid, then you have a preferred slicing.
Yes, yeah.
Is it responsive or sensitive to special types of slicing?
Well, to take your first point, if you have matter which is generally collapsing, your favorite supernova code or something like that, where in the core collapse is pretty universal, then that would be a good way of picking the frame, yes, because the matter itself is collapsing. If, on the other hand, again, we could break that criterion by inventing examples where there's a little explosion going off at one point and some of the matter is expanding. It's not indifferent enough. I mean, that's what I was saying a minute ago. I think we need a more indifferent theorem here.
Can I just